Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm delighted to welcome someone I have known for a very, very long time, a good friend who I lost touch with, a well-accomplished journalist, author, and a thinker, Mr. Vasuki Shastri from Dubai, UAE. Vasuki, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Ashutosh. Delighted to be here.
Thank you. Vasuki is a strategic consultant with and an Asia watcher at the Chatham House. He's an author. He has been an economic and political journalist in India, Singapore, and Jakarta. He has worked for the International Monetary Fund. He's an author of several books, and we'll talk about his books. These are Resurgent Indonesia, From Crisis to Confidence, and Has Asia Lost It? His book, Has Asia Lost It, was a finalist at the American Book Festival Awards, Book Fest Award in 2021. He's also a commissioner of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. So Vasuki, what a great delight it is to meet you after so many years. And let's start our conversation talking about Chatham House and your role there.
Thank you so much, Ashutosh. You know, I've been an Asia watcher through my career, by virtue of being a journalist in India and Southeast Asia. Then when I worked both for the IMF, Singapore Central Bank, and Standard Chartered Bank, I had an opportunity to work extensively on, you know, the economic financial context. So I've essentially spent my career, even though I haven't lived in Asia for many, many years, I've traveled frequently and work has brought me back. So when I describe myself as an Asia watcher for Chatham House, it's that collective career that I've had. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm an associate fellow in the Asia Pacific program. Chatham House, for those who don't know, is a renowned international think tank, headquartered, of course, in the UK. It had its centenary year last year. Unfortunately, we could not spend it in person because of COVID. And, you know, the Asia-Pacific program looks at very broad economic, social, technological, and political contexts. Mm-hmm. It does it across cross-cutting issues and also looks at countries. Obviously, China, India, Indonesia are front and center. So my role really is to pick and choose. You know, I'm at a stage in my career where it's not a full-time job. Mm-hmm. I can dip in and out on issues that I am interested in. And those issues at this point in time are economic and financial integration in Asia, interplay between technology and democracy, and global governance. And these are three issues I look at both at a regional thematic level, as well as, you know, do some deep dives into countries. So the three countries that I am fascinated with, China, India, and Indonesia.
Amazing.
So I look at these issues from ground up, how it is impacting these countries. And you know, I write, I contribute, participate in conferences as any think tanker should do.
Wonderful. Absolutely incredible. So then let's talk a little bit about China, India, and Indonesia. Let's start with a question on what has been the impact of the pandemic on the economies of these three giant countries. I mean, China has recently announced its lowest GDP ever in the last quarter. Indonesia is also talking of high growth, and India seems to have had a good quarter. I'd love to get your perspective on where are these three countries heading economically?
Yeah, I think on the pandemic, I think the comparison will really be valid if you compare how Asia, China, India, Indonesia, mm-hmm. being part of it, mm-hmm. how do they fare economically compared with, say, the UK mm-hmm. or the US, which I would argue was severely impacted by the lockdowns that came with the pandemic? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you look at the roll call of economic numbers from 2021 and 2020, you'll see a number of European countries and a number of, obviously, US and other developed countries. Mm-hmm. which reported negative growth.
Correct.
And if you look at Asia, Asia, I think, has done relatively well compared with the advanced West. Mm-hmm. And so even in India, right? So in India, you've got to measure. So if you look at pure GDP numbers, mm-hmm. I think 2021 has been a pretty impressive year for India because mm-hmm. the base effect of 2020, you had negative growth. But still, I think still in relative terms, I think Asia has held up rather well mm-hmm. economically. Mm-hmm. And even in China today, you're talking about a rather severe lockdown in many parts of the country.
Correct.
You know, many ports have been shut. But still, China may report 4.5% growth, mm-hmm. which, you know, by the high standards that we hold China, may seem like a severe slowdown. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's still positive growth. And, you know, we should not be fussy when a country reports positive growth. So I would say that on pure economic statistic mm-hmm. terms, these three countries and the rest of the region has held up rather well. Mm. But I think where we begin to see the negativity and the difficult is in the humanitarian side, in the impact this has had on lives and livelihoods, even in China, which is, you know, a much more advanced country compared with India and Indonesia,
correct.
Where the state has greater capacity to provide social assistance. Mm. Even in China, you're seeing economic distress.
Mm.
So I think one lesson moving forward for the region really would be, you're going to have crises in the future.
Mm.
But I think this COVID has provided an extreme lesson in how you can build social resilience during a crisis. And hopefully those lessons will be learned. Mm. So the impact on the poorest will be protected.
Fascinating. So, you know, yesterday I was listening to President Xi Jinping's speech at Davos. And I heard one of his earlier speeches. And he's constantly talking about little groups being formed, and clearly these are anti-China groups, whether it's AUKUS or whether it's the Quad or whether it's the economic groupings getting formed. And for the president of a $13 trillion economy, for him to be raising these issues, only for someone who doesn't know China as well as you do, someone seems to be hurting quite seriously. I'd love to get your perspective.
Yeah, you know, I think Asia and China are the big geopolitical dramas of our time.
Mm.
And I think we all grew up, Ashutosh, at a time in India where the defining conflict of our generation was the US and USSR.
Correct.
The Cold War,
mm.
you know, so that was a very different context. And I think the new generation, their defining moment for the next few decades is going to be this tussle between an existing superpower in the form of the US
correct.
And a superpower which believes its time has come in the form of China. And, you know, China has clearly under President Xi Jinping has decided that its time in history has come. That probably explains some of the assertiveness that we've seen in China, not only with the border tensions that have gone on between India and China over the past 2 years, but more generally in the South China Sea. China has contested many, many islands and islets as being part of its own history and geography. China plays a much more critical role in Africa's economic development today by the sheer amount of financial exposure that it has. So this is a power which believes that its time has come. Mm. It has to be taken seriously. And I think where the difficulty comes is, there's one entire school of thought that Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping famously said 3 or 4 decades ago, that until the time is right, China should bide its time and bury its head and focus on economic development.
Correct.
And I think that strategy really worked well for China, its transformation in pure economic and social terms. You know, it's been incredible. It's been really remarkable. And we've got to give credit where it's due.
Correct.
I think where we are beginning to see tensions is this assertiveness on China's part on making claims that could perhaps be resolved through negotiations. But I think the world is waking up to that rising China, and the fact that President Xi Jinping will spend a portion of a speech at the virtual Davos demonstrates that China feels that it is not being loved universally by its neighbors. And certainly, I think from a South Asia perspective, from what you see in India, I think China has lost goodwill, I think, for a generation through its actions. And you can perhaps make the same argument in East Asia and other parts of the world. And I think, you know, from a very, very pragmatic point of view, I think the world and Asia needs economically dynamic China. Correct. And China needs an economically dynamic Asia and the rest of the world. So you would hope that there would be a reset where the focus would be on lifting living standards, dealing with the pandemic,
correct,
rather than making these geopolitical claims.
Correct. So continuing with China, you know, in the 90s, when you and I were in Singapore, that was the time when the Soviet Union and Gorbachev had brought in glasnost and perestroika. And one of the things that people said was that the reason the Soviet Union split up was because they decided to have economic liberalization, political liberalization before economic stability. And that was the reason China has been succeeding, Deng Xiaoping's case in point. But I was talking to some other people recently, and a new perspective seems to be emerging that with an economic slowdown coming in China, is this the right time for Xi Jinping to become politically assertive? And what will be the impact? Because the economic impact of the pandemic is very, very severe in China. I'd love to get your perspective.
Yeah, you know, there are two completely different schools of thought on this in the geopolitical community. And I'm by no means a China expert, but I study the country very closely. There's one, the collapse of the Soviet Union, which Vladimir Putin calls the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century.
Correct.
And I think the Chinese leadership has taken lots of important lessons on board. And they seem to believe in this proposition that if you have this social compact where you're delivering, where the government is delivering economic growth and better social outcomes year upon year, then the population is easily satisfied and they're not going to want greater political freedoms. And I think in many, many countries, this proposition has been tested, been severely tested. And we've seen in China's own neighborhood, including part of its own territory in Hong Kong, you've got this battle, which has since been suppressed for greater freedom on the part of the people. So I think the belief that China can plow on and even those economic freedoms, Ashutosh, are being curtailed. If you see the action that the Chinese government has taken against the big tech, you know, Alibaba and Tencent, in really curtailing their ability to collect data, curtailing their ability to expand, really shows that we are living now in the Chinese state, which has complete command and control over all levers of the economy. And which really suggests that if there is friction, if there is an event which triggers social unrest, that can really turn very bad very, very quickly. And I think the thing about democracies, and I think democracies in the last decade have gotten a very bad name. The thing about democracies is there's a pressure valve for people to express their views, to express their concern about the state, which in China, people arguably had greater freedoms two decades ago. Those freedoms are completely being curtailed. So you've got these two theories. One is China can completely control the destiny and will plow on for the next few decades. And then there's a skeptical bunch who believe that, you know, this will be unsustainable. This cannot go on. one-man rule cannot go on forever. Mm. And at some stage, and there are arguments on what that stage is going to be, China is going to behave like a normal country where people will demand greater political freedom.
Well said. So let me move now to India. You know, you've been observing India. You're a person of Indian origin. I'd love to get your perspective on how is India being perceived economically? And I'd like to stay away from politics, but how is India being perceived economically around the world?
Yeah, you know, there was a time, I would say, until 2014, 2015, mm-hmm. India was the example for the world. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean this just
sure.
Because mm-hmm. India happens to be the largest democracy in the world. But I think for many, many people, and I've met people across the world mm. who really see India as an example of a country with incredibly complex political, social dynamics.
Absolutely.
Which for a period of time was able to demonstrate the power of economic reforms, the mm. fact that you can have mm. sustained economic growth for a long period of time, which lifts living standards, reduces poverty. And I think that example of India is shameless these days. Mm. And there are obviously political factors which you rightly said we should not focus on. Mm-hmm. So let me look at the pure economic factors at play. Mm-hmm. So when the Indian, and this is really not a commentary on any, so in my book, both political parties which were in power had an opportunity
correct.
To reset India, and they failed in doing that. Mm. Right. So India's problems predate this government.
Yeah.
When times were really good, there's a saying at the IMF, when times are really good, it's good to fix your roof. Mm. And I think when India grew at that 8% pace mm. in the 2000s mm. and the 2010s, there was a great sense of complacency within the country, certainly within the government, that you can, you know, postpone mm. the really difficult economic reforms
true.
That we needed. Now, I recognize GST was mm. introduced, mm. which is a necessary way, a necessary step in reforming indirect taxes mm. In the country. And I think that's, I know people have problems with implementation, but I think basically that's a very sound mm. idea. You've had problems on land acquisition, you've had problems on labor reforms.
Yeah.
And there was a period of time when the economy was chugging at 9%, mm. when the pain of implementing reforms, in a way you get inoculated because mm. the world economy is growing well and India's tide is getting lifted. Mm. Economic reforms are very, very difficult when the economy begins to slow,
correct.
Which is what I think is India's challenge mm. over the past decade mm. has been, where, for example, in the financial system, which for a period of time froze up. Mm. There was no liquidity flowing in to help, you know, the medium businesses and the small businesses. Mm. That really hurt economic growth and outcomes. So I would argue that India does best at a time of crisis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, certainly this pandemic has shown that economic growth has really tumbled. Mm-hmm. And I think India has a great opportunity. If you look in the neighborhood, and if you look more generally in the world, mm. right? So if you compare India with the BRICS, mm. right? So let's leave China aside yeah. for a moment. Mm. China is, you know, advanced, well advanced. Mm-hmm. So if you look at Brazil, you look at Russia, you look at South Africa, you look even at Indonesia. Mm. These are countries which give or take a few thousand, maybe higher in per capita GDP or lower. But I think the sheer potential of India mm. to expand, to be able to grow. Very few countries, developing countries in the world, have this mm. capacity to grow mm. for about 8%, 9% mm. For the next decade, as India has. Mm. So, you know, India has really been snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, the way right. I see it from my... And there's tremendous scope. And I think the... Ashutosh, you'll remember in the 1990s, all these foreign magazines used to say India is the sleeping elephant, India is the tiger in the cage. And I think those metaphors are very relevant even to India today. And I think there's an economy waiting to be uncaged.
I agree.
If only the government gets out of the way.
So, you know, a very senior Singapore businessman friend commented to me a couple of years ago. He says, you know, since 1991, when Prime Minister Narasimha Rao had come to Singapore and I was part of his delegation, he says, we've been talking about the India opportunity since then. It's now 3 decades. When will this opportunity begin to get realized? I'd love to get your perspective.
Yeah, you know, there's this joke people make in Brazil that, you know, Brazil is the country of the future and will always be. And I hope this fate does not befall India. And to be fair, there have been foreign investors and domestic investors who capitalized on the India opportunity.
Correct.
So it's probably not fair to say there has not been investment opportunity in India, starting from the Narasimha Rao reforms. Mm. There have been, and you know, the fact that you've got India's got this very vibrant startup sector now, where you've seen a lot of these unicorns in the e-commerce payments space, shows that there is this uncaged potential. And I think foreign investors, depending on which sector they've been, you know, have had a mixed experience investing in India. But I think what really sets India apart from other developing countries is, you know, the really strong domestic private sector.
Correct.
Which is not just, I mean, obviously very strong set of family-owned businesses, but you've also had this new generation of entrepreneurs starting with, you know, Infosys and Wipro.
Correct.
30, 40 years ago,
yeah,
who've provided this very strong foundation. So I think, you know, compared to Indonesia, for example, where you need foreign investment into specific sectors, I think India has that private sector foundation where it can plow on its own. But the question is, I think, really government regulation and lack of reforms is holding back.
Well said, well said. So, Vasuki, I'm now going to move to your books. I would have loved to keep on talking about Indonesia, and you know, you have such a wealth of knowledge in these areas. But given our time constraints, I'd like to come to your books. Tell me about, first, congratulations on being a finalist at the American Book Fest Award in 2021 for Has Asia Lost It? But before I come to the books, for our viewers and listeners, are these books available on Amazon?
Yes, they're both available on Amazon, yes.
Wonderful. So let's start with Has Asia Lost It? And tell me what is the hypothesis and some of your key comments on that.
Yeah, the hypothesis of Has Asia Lost It is, and Ashutosh, you've done a fair share of business travel in your time. Well, I used to go to an airport bookshop at Changi or New Delhi. One would always be tempted to buy books. And, you know, I used to notice, and this is really a reflection of the period from 2010 to 2018, 2019, where I found that almost all the nonfiction books in an airport bookstore had titles like Asia Rising, Asia Shining. And there wasn't any book which was really offering the contra proposition that the region still faces lots of economic and social problems, which it needs to overcome. And this proposition was severely tested in my case in an auto rickshaw ride in Mumbai. Few years ago, where I met this very, very interesting auto rickshaw driver, Pramod, and I asked him a series of questions on how well the Indian economy was doing and how he was benefiting from it. He really snapped back. He told me, you know that I live, we both will live in the same country, but I live in heaven and he lives in hell because his economic outcomes we're still extremely nebulous from what he saw. So that is the seed of the book, to say that is there a proposition that with all its potential and all its promise, which is self-evident, does developing Asia, right? So when we talk about Asia, we've got to be careful. We've got to separate out developing from developed Asia. So we don't need to worry about the Asian tigers and Japan. We need to worry about, I would argue, we need to worry still about China. and the rest of the developing parts, including India. Mm-hmm. So the book's proposition is the world economy is changing. Globalization as we know it, which the region has benefited from, the nature of that is changing because, you know, in Europe, in the US, there's a backlash. Mm-hmm. So first, does Asia have a different economic model in case globalization rolls back? And what are some of the political and social problems that the region is facing, with recognition that each country has its own very unique set of challenges? And so, you know, I really explored these problems, getting away from the ivory tower. You know, again, you know, whenever one went to Asia on a business trip, one stayed in a luxury hotel and one tended to meet only people who violently agreed with you that Asia's time has come.
Absolutely.
And I had an opportunity in my previous job at Standard Chartered to get away from that comfort zone, meet with, you know, NGOs, meet with small business. And I came away from a less hopeful proposition. Okay. So the book is really a challenge.
Mm.
It's a challenge for discussion that, you know, before we proclaim that Asia's time has come, we should pause a little and look at some of the social challenges. And I started writing the book before the pandemic. Right. The pandemic kind of confirmed my hypothesis in a very, very tragic way. And the book has triggered debate, which is essentially what I wanted.
Amazing. Amazing. Vasuki, we run out of time now, but I just want to say on that note, thank you so much for speaking to me. Thank you for talking to me at such length on two areas that you are passionate about, which is China and India, what is happening economically. And thank you for talking to me about your book. We didn't have time to talk about your other book, Resurgent Indonesia, but maybe we'll do a separate session on Indonesia because we didn't talk about the economics of Indonesia, which is one of the three countries you track closely. Thank you again very much.
Thank you so much for your time, Ashutosh. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.